Okay, of course, the 4th of July coming up, which means we're right in the middle of summer. The other major part of summer in moviedom is the blockbuster. And so we thought it might be fun to take a little bit of a look at blockbusters historically, maybe what makes them work, maybe some that haven't quite worked as well, and then maybe take a look at really what the biggest blockbusters of all time have been and whether they were even worth it. So, Jed, I'm going to ask you, what do you think? What makes a blockbuster successful? Why is one going to work?
Well, you use the word movie dumb, and I imagine that spelled movie D-U-M-B. And there is this kind of element of a blockbuster has to be a movie that you don't really have to think about. It has to be a movie that can transcend your age, race, class, gender, so on and so forth. So it has to be appealing to the broadest possible audience. And at the same time, I think it also has to play upon some element of what's going on currently. So when I look at the proliferation, for instance, and the popularity of comic book movies over the last, what, decade plus, it says something to me, I think, about like our time. It says something about our expectations as people. It says something about this. And if I go back to Jaws or something like that, and I look at the era that that film comes from, it says a lot to me about what was going on there. There's this kind of terror of the unknown, and people are fearful of the unknown, and there's so much emphasis on that kind of stuff. So what makes a blockbuster? For me, a lot of times, it's pretty much anything that I would avoid.
I actually like blockbusters, and I go to see them quite a bit. I've actually, confession, I've seen every superhero movie within the past 20 years.
That's great.
I think there's an art to making a franchise. I think setting up all these pieces and, you know, having things set up in place and then having culminate 7-8 years down the line, 8 movies in, is just fascinating to me. And also, you know, this whole idea of foreign box office numbers is fascinating to me as well, trying to appeal to other people. Now, does that make for a good movie? Not always. But, you know, sometimes it can lend itself to something interesting.
I think I'm somewhere in the middle of the two of you. I don't necessarily ignore blockbusters completely, as it sounds like Jed does. And I certainly have not seen every superhero movie of the past 20 years like Hugo. Really, I've only seen a handful of the superhero movies of the past few years. And part of that is because it's very hard at some point to make something new, to bring something new into the picture. A lot of these superhero movies, of course, are being made because they have a built-in audience. There are a lot of people who know these characters, and that's kind of a shorthand that the filmmakers then can use to take them off into their adventures. However, you end up with something like The Avengers that Joss Whedon did that is quite clever, and it ends up being a lot of fun, and it ends up as also being a blockbuster, as opposed to, say, the Transformers movies that Michael Bay does, which do quite well financially, but which are complete messes when you watch them as movies. Certainly, like you said, the superhero movie is really where the trend has gone. If you look at the top 10 box office movies of all time, or domestic or worldwide, then the superhero movies, there are quite a few on that list. However, and I think this might change a little bit about what you were saying about movie dumb, Jed. When you look at the top 10 movies of all time as adjusted for inflation, obviously we know that movie ticket prices have exponentially increased over time. If you actually adjust for inflation, you get a little bit of a different picture. The one common thread is spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
All of these movies are big. Many of them are epic in length and not just scale. But there's some really interesting stuff here. Number 10 on the list, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, that's not something that you think of as big and a giant spectacle, but this isn't completely true, but it's more or less recognized as the first animated feature film. And that's really a big deal. It was a big deal at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at the list, you see something like, you know, I was kind of talking about the zeitgeist element, certainly The Exorcist and E.T. Very much capture something about the age in which these films were released. And, you know, Jaws, you know, as I mentioned earlier, which remains this great kind of iconic film. And at the same time, I think that these films also, at least a majority of them, tended to break new ground in some way.
I agree with that completely. And when you look at the list, with a couple of exceptions, I'm just going to run down the list really quickly. With a couple of exceptions, they are genuinely good movies. From 10 to 1, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, The Exorcist, Dr. Zhivago. That one actually surprised me a little bit, although that's probably just the fact that I wasn't alive to see in the theater. I'm sure it was a huge deal. Jaws, which a lot of people recognize as being the movie that created the summer blockbuster. Ten Commandments, another giant movie. Titanic, of course. E.T., The Sound of Music, which won Best Picture. Star Wars, and I'm not 100% sure if that Star Wars number includes the re-release from 1997 re-release or not. Regardless, Star Wars was, as we know, a big hit. And then number one of all time, and maybe never will be beat, as we adjust for inflation at least, is Gone with the Wind. I personally would say, other than the Ten Commandments and Gone with the Wind, which I think has not aged well at all, and just Gone with the Wind is not one of my favorite movies. I don't think it's aged well. But with the exception of those two, I think all of the others really are good movies. Titanic, a lot of people have some trouble with the acting and the silly story, but it is a great spectacle as far as that goes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think one of the factors that these movies made so much money, particularly back then, is that movies were in theaters a lot longer than they are now.
Yeah, I can remember as a kid going to see, for instance, Star Wars probably twice in its initial release cycle. It was like it came around, and of course we got it late because I lived in the middle of nowhere, so we got it several months after it had had its initial wave, and then it came around like 6 months later or something, and you could go and see it again, you know, and this is pre-video. So I think that was also part of it.
Now the studio cycle is so set in its ways, and you can like look at a year and know exactly how long a movie is going to last in theaters, when a movie would come out, and just there's a life cycle for a movie now.
The world's definitely changed. Everything's geared toward opening weekend now. How much can we make in the first weekend? Can we do $180 million? Are we going to break all of the records? It used to be that you would talk about a movie having legs.
Yeah.
And those legs are what, as you said, brought a lot of these movies historically, again, adjusted for inflation, to put them on the top 10 of this list, were those legs. Something I thought about that's not on any of these lists because it didn't make enough money in terms of gross, but did an amazing job in terms of total profit, that did have legs and technically did come out during the summer blockbuster season, was My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah.
Made for about $500,000. It made maybe close to $360 million worldwide. And that is a movie that was in the theaters for probably a year. I did not go see it until it was probably a year old in the theaters. And my mom finally convinced me to go see it. Those little things I find completely charming because we've got these giant blockbusters. As I said, spectacle is almost always the common thread. But then you end up with some little thing like My Big Fat Greek Wedding that makes many, many, many more times than it ever costs to make and just surprises everybody with its success.
You know, that's so hard to do today, particularly just because there's only two subsets of movies now. There's giant blockbusters and tiny indie movies. There's no middle anymore. That's why you don't see romantic comedies. You don't see adult dramas. You don't see any of those type of things anymore. Even movies with giant A-list actors don't draw people in anymore. A couple months ago, Money Monster came out. George Clooney, Julia Roberts. You think that would, you know, draw a bunch of people? Didn't really make that much money.
Yeah, 10 years ago, that would have been huge. And I saw it and I was just, I kind of scratched my head and went, well, I didn't see it. I saw the title and I kind of read a little bit about it and I kind of scratched my head and I sort of passed. I think that you're right. I mean, we've talked before about the idea of sleeper hits, and I think that this tendency to push for the box office and push for the opening weekend has kind of eliminated a lot of those subtleties. And that's, you know, when I talk about not really liking the blockbuster, I think that's some of it, because it's like these films don't ask very much for me. They don't ask me to engage on a lot of levels. The Batman movies, in my opinion, do. But most of them, it's like, I know how this is going to end. I know how it's going to go. So it kind of takes a lot of the fun for me out of seeing a film.
And there's an ecosystem with the blockbuster and independent films now, too. So if you're an up-and-coming director, you just came out with like a major hit indie film, you're going to be snatched up by a giant studio to direct a giant blockbuster.
Yep.
And sometimes you crash and burn, mm-hmm. you know, because you're young and you don't know much. And you just directed something for $3 million and now you've been handled $120 million, and you're like, what am I going to do with this? So it's hard.
Yeah. I think you can look at if we take this trend and we look at how it's gone in other industries, other elements of entertainment, it tends to have a negative outcome, this kind of let's just throw cash at it. I mean, you can look at television and, True Detective is a good example of there's a show that had a great first season, was praised for its artfulness and wit and brains and everything else. And so the second season was a complete and utter disaster. And they said, no more of this. And I think that could be potentially a real danger with cinema, is that you get these inexperienced directors to helm these big budget movies, and they begin flopping. And so they just, there becomes no farm league for directors. They get handed to more experienced filmmakers, and you get this real kind of set factory type element to them.
Certainly, money has always been an important part of the Hollywood system, but there is probably something to be said about, as expensive as these movies are, perhaps not paying as much for a real established solid action director and paying for some up and coming director. And good for them. I'm glad those guys are making money doing what they want to do. But as Hugo said, sometimes it doesn't always translate well. Again, that's another reason I think that The Avengers was so successful. Joss Whedon, not exactly somebody who's worked on that sort of scale before, but certainly someone who knows how to write witty dialogue, which makes a movie fun, and then someone who has at least directed action sequences, even if it was just Buffy the Vampire Slayer, kicking some vampire butt.
He had Serenity.
And he did have Serenity, so Space Cowboys. But again, nothing on that scale. But Joss Whedon, clearly someone who is a very capable film director. And that's, again, as you said, not always the case for sure when we bring in these up-and-coming directors.
One of the things I want to figure out is what would the careers of these independent directors be like, if they had not been snatched up by these studios to make big blockbuster movies. If you think about it, like, look at the 90s boom of independent movies. Imagine if Richard Linklater was snatched up right after Dazed and Confused and made to direct a Terminator movie. Mm-hmm. It'd be weird. It just, what would his career be like right now? So imagine what the career of maybe somebody like Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World, be like if, right after Safety Not Guaranteed, he directed another indie film instead of this giant, massive, second highest grossing movie of 2015 movie.
Well, I think you're describing Steven Soderbergh. I think he spent a lot of time figuring out what his aesthetic was. He talks poorly about some of his early movies, talks well about some others, but then he kind of had a personal breakdown and made a movie called Schizopolis, which is completely nuts, although it's something that I really enjoy. And then he figured himself out and he made Traffic, which he won Best Director for. He made the Ocean's 11, 12, and 13 movies, which are complete delights. Mm-hmm. And he was able to figure out his voice. He was able to figure out what interested him, and then was able to move on to make these real blockbusters, again, the Ocean's movies, and then to intersperse those with his little passion projects and the things that really interested him. I think that's the sort of thing we would end up with if we allowed these talented filmmakers to grow in their own way instead of just tossing them into the blockbuster pool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you look at George Lucas, who went from American Graffiti.
Mm-hmm. Or THX.
THX 1138.
Yeah.
Straight into American Graffiti.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, but I do like the idea of Slackinator. So.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Richard Linklater, please, 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 I know you're listening, make a Terminator movie. Okay, blockbusters, everybody loves them except Jed. That's not completely true. We love them, we hate them. Blockbusters are probably generally here to stay regardless. We could go ahead and wrap this up. Hugo Fan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jed, as always, it's a pleasure.
All right, thank you much.
And I'm Fletcher Powell.